Session number 216504.
George Gardner, real form.
I arrived in Freetown. I went to the hospital with malaria. I'd already knew before I left the ship that we were sailing for home the day after. When I arrived at the hospital, the Queen Alexandria nurse there, she said, "We can admit you straight away, and you'll be about a week." Well, I said to her, I said, "I'm going home in the morning." I said, "I've already been here 2 years, and you were only supposed to do 18 months on the Freetown station." She said, "Well, on one condition," and she told the sick bay lad that was with me, "he takes these tablets, drinks 8 pints of water morning, and 8 pints of water in the afternoon, and takes these tablets," which were called Mefacrin. I had 18 of those to take every day, 18 Mefacrin tablets, and there were 54 altogether, 3 days supply. She said, "After that, you should be all right." What she didn't tell me, the Mefacrin tablets dyed my entire body a bright yellow. So I arrived home in Preston looking like a Chinaman. Yellow skin, which lasted for about 2 months after I'd gone back to depot after leave. When I got back to depot after leave, they told me the Dittany had finished their wartime experiences, and I was put in charge of the Dittany in a little creek, Laughing Waters, off the Thames.
You were in charge of it?
Yeah. I was in charge of four ratings and me. We were night watchmen, just caretakers for the corvette.
Where is this creek?
Laughing Waters.
Where's that?
Nearly opposite Gillingham. It's a little creek that runs up off the River Thames, where they were storing corvettes that were finished. The war had nearly over then for corvettes. There were no more convoys or anything.
You mean in Kent or Essex?
Oh, Kent, yes. And on board the ship, it was empty. Just before Christmas it was. And the lads that were with me were all from London. So I used to let them go on leave every night, and they gave me every weekend. I could go every weekend up to Preston. We had to empty the ship and clean it, starting at the stern and work the whole way through. Every cabin, captain's cabin, everything like that had to be stripped and cleaned. Christmas Day.
Is this after the war?
Just after the war. I was the only one left on board. And this cutter came round from one corvette to another. He gave me the biggest turkey I've ever seen in my life, cooked. Big dish of potatoes, Brussels sprouts, green peas, carrots, Christmas pudding. There's your Christmas dinner. Happy Christmas, cheerio. Now, if you've ever had a Christmas dinner on your own, with the biggest turkey I've ever seen. Anyhow, I sat there on my own, feeling sorry for myself at Christmas Eve, and I heard footsteps on the upper deck. Now, there was no way they could get on the upper deck unless they got a boat from the bank to come to us. And I thought, what's going on here, like, you know? Well, all we had for defence was a pickaxe handle, typical Navy, like, a pickaxe handle and a torch. So I went on the upper deck and stood at the stern of the ship was a Royal Marine. I shouted at him, he turned around, he said, "Is it you, George?" I said, "Yeah." I looked at him. Jack Lord had gone to school with him. He joined the Royal Marines. I hadn't seen him all the war, and we were both stationed there. He was at Gillingham, and he'd heard that I was on board here. So I had Christmas. We had Christmas dinner again, so both of us together. We started to clear, after he'd gone back, like the rest of the lads, we started to clear all the cabins. We came down to the coxswain's cabin. Now, the coxswain was in charge of all the ratings. And he also had a little shop on board. He sold chocolates and cigarettes and all that. We opened this cabin. I had all the keys. It was absolutely stocked full of chocolate, bars of chocolate and cigarettes. So, well, what can we do? We divided them into four. There was four of us on board, three ratings and me. He took one lot, took them up to London, got rid of them. I took them up. Well, I couldn't be bothered carrying mine, so I let these lads have the chocolate and I kept the cigarettes to bring home. We worked out with about 1,000 cigarettes each and half a dozen bars of chocolate. It was just a little shop that he kept on board for this rating. Also in his desk was a full parcel of ration cards for ratings to go along with him and get the rations with, and travel warrants for anywhere in England. You don't need to put the name of the station on them. And I'd sign it, and we had a ship stamping. They were going 30 miles up to from Gillingham to London, these lads, with a travel warrant every night. We were travel warrants and ration cards. I think our families then had more rations than anybody else with these cards. Anyhow, we managed to clear the entire ship's thing out. And the last cabin we came to was in the forecastle. And that had never been opened. I'd never seen it opened. But I had the key, we opened it, and inside was parcels fastened up in sacking, about a foot square, 18 inch or a foot square, so covered with sacking and then stitched. So we thought, well, we opened it. We opened one of these sackings, opened the parcel, and each parcel contained a pair of grey flannels, underpants, shirt, shoes and socks. They were survivors. If we picked any survivors up, they were generally covered with oil. We could give them one of these, but we never picked any survivors up, so we never had to use them. And there were 31 of these, 31 bundles. Well, they were all different sizes, and it weren't worth going through them. So one of the lads said he'd take them up to London. He could sell them. He said, you know, usual black market. He came back with £100, which in them days was a lot of money, between four of us. I thought this little Corvette's a little gold mine to us lot, you know. Anyhow, it finished, and I had to go. I got a message on board, send the crew, rest of them ashore now, as they were coming to mothball the ship. They covered it with some kind of stuff and sealed every hatchway for further use in any of the war, you know. But I asked this chap, I said, are they going to be mothballed? He said, no. He said, we're just taking them further up the creek and they're going to be scrapped for scrap iron, you know. So I had to report then to an RAF station at Laughing Waters. There was an RAF station ashore. I had to go there and wait for demobilisation. And that came within about a week. And we went up to Victoria Station, London. And there, back of Victoria Station, was a big warehouse covered with everything you could want to be demobilised with. Suits, overcoats, Macintoshes, shoes. If they hadn't a suit to fit you, they'd measure you and you'd send it on later. But I had one to fit. I got one to fit off the peg, you know. It was a horrible suit now, as I come to think about it. But I was that keen to get home, you know. And that's about it. I got home and they gave me a month's leave.
Going back to your period in West Africa, did you run into the enemy during that period?
It was one night, and we were taking this, it was only a small convoy of about 8 ships, and during the night, we knew there was a submarine somewhere near, but we didn't think it was near us. But one of the destroyers picked a submarine up on the Asdic, and the submarine sailed through the convoy, not submerged, above water. And I was on an Orlikan then, and we all opened fire at that submarine. There must have been 20-odd Orlikans, 4-inch, everything. But it just carried on serenely sailing away. We didn't do it any damage whatsoever, it submerged. And then we depth charged it, we still didn't get it. Another time, there was a submarine scare, and we followed this submarine for over 100 miles. And then an RAF Sunderland boat came out. You've got to remember, on the corvette, you haven't got the class of officer you had on a battleship. You're no regular Navy officers. They were all those 4 that I told you at the beginning from every class who were entitled to become officers. They were them. And they hadn't a clue, really. And we depth charged this submarine for hours and hours and trailed it and depth charged it. And then a Sunderland torpedo boat came over and told us we were depth charging the biggest log of wood he'd ever seen below water. And it was we got the log, they towed the log out, towed it back to shore. It was a teak, solid teak, and it was about 10 foot below the water, and it was just floating along, and we depth charged that log. And I think depth charges then were £64 a piece, the cost. We must have used about 60. But Freetown was getting very quiet then, and then they started flying the Yanks home, and we used to have to go halfway between Africa and South America. They were flying up to South America and then going up by train from there, from Rio de Janeiro. And we used to anchor, and planes were going overhead steadily, flying the Yanks home. That was one of the little jobs we did. But it came quiet compared with the war spy.
How was it that so many people firing guns at a U-boat which had surfaced in a convoy should miss it?
Well, I was using an Orlikan, and it fires a shell that weighs about a pound, about that big when it's left the cartridge.
5 inches?
5 inches long. And they used to say if it went through brown paper, it exploded. And they were all exploding along the deck of the submarine, Orlikan shells, all over it. But they weren't going through. You know what I mean? We weren't penetrating, we hadn't armour piece and stuff. They had a gun crew on the upper deck when we started firing. They all disappeared, whether we hit them or they went below. And then the submarine started to submerge slowly and it just cleared off. As soon as it started submerging, we dashed over to where it had submerged, started dropping depth charges. But the thing they do straight away, they may be going that way when we started to twirl, it had turned around and come the opposite way. Until you pick it up, the noise of all the screws, you can't pick a submarine up so easy. But we used to pick them up and you could hear the ping on the upper deck. We used to, when they were searching for one, they had the ping, ping, ping. As soon as it hit something, ping, ding. It would come back to you. And we had that on like a microphone on the upper deck. We could hear it. But we still couldn't know the depth proper. And these depth charges, you had a key on the end of them, and you could set them from 200 feet to 1,000, which was pretty near the limit of a submarine. But we were never successful. We never had a submarine to our credit.
Were the submarines causing casualties amongst the convoys?
Well, about then they were getting pretty desperate with submarines. They'd come above. We'd had air superiority then. We had the flying boats. Wherever we were in a convoy, we'd a flying boat over us all day. Nothing at night. That's when the submarines operated at night mostly, and they didn't do damage right until the end of the war.
So you saw losses of ships to do?
Oh yeah, we in that convoy from we brought from Londonderry to Gibraltar. There was about six ships went down. Well, I don't know whether they went down. They blew up at night and set on fire. They were torpedoed. Whether the crew were rescued or not, we don't know. We never stopped to pick any crew up, unless they were very near us.
What chances did they stand of surviving if they went into the sea?
Very little. Because if they went into the sea opposite, straight overboard from their own ship, they'd oil to contend with straight away. Or if it wasn't oil, and it was very cold at the time, you could give them 5 minutes in the water if they couldn't get on a raft or a boat. 5 minutes in the water and they were dead.
But it wouldn't be cold in West Africa, would it?
Oh, off West Africa, the water was never cold, no. But that convoy from Londonderry, which is in the Atlantic, North Atlantic nearly, going down, they wouldn't stand a lot of chance with that. We're very cold. Yeah.
Any other stories from West Africa?
We went from coming home from West Africa. One of our lads on board developed yellow fever, and there was no cure. So we put into Vigo in northern Spain, and we were allowed to go in for 24 hours, then we had to come out again. Then we were allowed to go in for 24 hours and come out again. There was a German ship in Vigo. Diesel ship, diesel engine she had, which had broken down. We took this lad ashore, and I think it was one of the officers on board, could speak a bit of Spanish, and he went with him and took a rating with him to the hospital. And then the hospital was run by nuns, these nuns. And the officer came back on board, he said, how embarrassed he was, he said, the rating knew we were dying, and he said he used the most foul language. He said he didn't know he was doing it. He just used most foul language against these nuns because they didn't understand his English. And they were Spanish. They're all Spanish, you know. Anyhow, he died, and we buried him in Vigo. And he was the only one of the crew off the corvette we lost. And he'd only joined the corvette a week before we come home from England. He'd been based ashore at Freetown, and they'd put him on board us to come home. But he hadn't yellow fever when he came on board, he only developed it.
Did you know him?
No, I didn't know him at all. No, he was only a young lad, Liverpool lad he was. I didn't know him at all. We thought he was shirking when he came on board. He never used to move, he'd sit on the upper deck and hang on to a post. We thought he was bothered with seasickness, but it wasn't. It was yellow water fever, and we didn't know nothing about yellow water fever until they got to ashore to this hospital. They kept us, and then they allowed us to stay in Vigo. We didn't have to keep going to sea again. I think the war must have finished just about then, and we were allowed to stay. And we sailed home with this German ship, Diesel, and put it into Falmouth Harbour and left it there when we went round to Thames, up the Thames, with the Dittany. We left the ship in Falmouth, German ship, and we came up the Thames.
Did you have any contact with the German crew?
We sold them, we never spoke to them. They seem to be all right, just like any other crew, you know. Oh, they had three women on board, cooks. And it seemed to be a well set up ship. It was bigger than the Corvette, just a bit bigger, painted black, swastika painted on the deck. But it had been in, they said it had been in Spain quite a while with the engine trouble.
Was there any armament in it?
No. And when we went ashore in Vigo, if we went into a bar for a drink, the police always followed us in. They wore a green uniform, olive green uniform, with a black shiny hat, and they were all armed with the revolvers. We'd never seen police armed with the revolvers until then. And you spoke to the Spaniards, tried to make conversation with them, and straight away after you'd gone, they went and spoke to the same Spaniards. It was Franco's Spain then.
What was the attitude of the population towards you at Vigo?
Really friendly. Yes, they were. We went to a circus in Vigo. There was a circus there. And it only started operating at 10 o'clock at night. They had the siesta, you know, in the afternoon. And we went to the 10 o'clock show. No, we could only have a 10 o'clock show because we had to be back on board for 12. And it only started at 11. And especially for us, they started at 10 so that we could get back on board at 12. They were very nice like that.
What were relations like between officers and crew in the Navy during the war?
On the Corvette, you just spoke to them as just as a mate. They were all right. They were just the lads. Our main officer, Lockley, his name was. Lieutenant, he became a lieutenant commander in the Wavy Navy. Lieutenant Commander Lockley. I believe it was some relation to the Wills, tobacco people, family, yeah.
And in the war spies?
War spies, the officers were officers. You were crew. They were regular Navy on the war spies.
How did they behave towards
all
the crew?
All right. Correct and proper.
How do you feel now about having served in the Navy in the Second World
War? I've enjoyed it. I can talk about the good parts and that, you know. The bad parts, it was bad for everybody. I used to think to myself, when I was in the Mediterranean, if I can live to be 21, I'll be happy. It got that, every time you went to sea, there were dive bombers and something over here. But I used to think, if I can live to be 21, I'll be happy, and probably it'll be over by then.
Have you had any after effects of having served?
No, I thought malaria would have after effects on me. But I started work at the atomic factory after I came out of the Navy. It's just up here, up the road. And they asked for blood donors. And I went to the doctors there and I said, like, I'd had malaria, would I be all right for blood donating? He said, well, took a sample of my blood and I waited a day or two and then he sent for me. He said, you have no signs of malaria whatsoever now, you're perfectly healthy. He said, we'll accept blood from you. So that was a good thing, really. That was the only thing that bothered me in the Navy, was malaria.
Any nightmares?
No. No, we didn't need any counselling.
Did it change your attitude towards life?
It has, really. Take one day at a time now. I just enjoy myself, you know. I do a lot of bowling and gardening. We go whisting every night, playing whist every night, me and the wife. She enjoys her whist. She enjoys her bowling. She's a very good bowler. So, well, you see the trophies outside there, what we've won, and everything's going great.